Hello and welcome to The Exit presented by Flippa. I'm your co-host, Steve McGarry, and this is a 30-minute podcast featuring amazing entrepreneurs who have been there and they have done it. We talk to operators who have bought and sold businesses of all different sizes. You'll learn how they did it, why they did it, and the exposure the world needs to see with all the different aspects of exiting a business. So in this episode, I sit down with Bart McDonald, the managing partner of Bloom Venture Partners. But before we get into this episode, definitely be sure to check out the previous episode with Kellyanne from Amazing Exits. It's a fantastic interview and it's definitely worth checking out. So the link to all that will be wherever you're listening to this episode. But for this episode, we're sitting down with Bart McDonald and we're going to be diving into SaaS businesses. We talk about everything around their sweet spot of investing in businesses that are doing 500 to 5 million in annual recurring revenue, and the fact that they're industry agnostic and geography agnostic. So wherever founders are, they are definitely investing. And most importantly, what we touch on is the fact that they are now actually buying SaaS businesses. So they have some really exciting knowledge nuggets at the end of the interview. So if you're really interested in SaaS businesses and potentially making even $1,000 for referring a SaaS business to them, definitely stick around to the end of the interview because Bart has some amazing knowledge to drop on everybody. So without further ado, let's dive right into my interview with Bart McDonald, the managing partner at Bloom Venture Partners. All right. I am here with Bart McDonald, the managing partner of Bloom Venture Partners. How are you doing today, Bart?
Hey, Steve. Really well, thanks. Yourself?
Doing great. Doing great. I'm excited to sit down and talk about subscription as a service.
Got a lot to cover.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that we like to do with guests is kind of go through an origin story. Like what brought you into Bloom and what were you doing previously?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been working in software companies, consumer and enterprise software for almost over a decade now. And originally as a founder and builder and operator, I've been kind of across many sides of the table, bootstrap companies, venture-backed companies, sold a few companies. And, you know, I kind of realized also as a just kind of commercial entrepreneur, I've also been across many different sides of the aisle there as well, kind of running service businesses, running marketplaces, and kind of realized a couple of years ago, you know, just in terms of business model quality and purity, and there's just so many advantages to software as a service. And, you know, I kind of think about wanting to get that stable, predictable, and importantly, recurring revenue base of revenue going. It's it's pretty amazing. I kind of liken it to Maslow's hierarchy, and there are a lot of business models where it's kind of consulting, and nothing wrong with consulting, but it's obviously, you know, generally non-recurring and you're kind of exchanging your time for a fee. And, you know, when you're not on the clock, it's hard to drive revenue for that business. And so, yeah, recognizing that there are, you know, there's a model that typically customers love, and obviously it's great from a commercial perspective. And I started doubling down on software as a service businesses to you know, continue build, but really got enamored after about 5-6 years in San Francisco, coming from Sydney, Australia, you know, starting to grow my network and realizing that there were a trove of founders far more remarkable than I, who kind of, you know, had, you know, great ideas for businesses that, you know, typically they were very technical as well. And oftentimes they were kind of first time founders building in SaaS, and, you know, had a lot of questions around how to think about product and company building, how to hire candidates, how to raise capital. And so I'll think, great. Maybe we'll see very talented folks, but if I can help you avoid some of the brain damage that I'd went through on building multiple companies, you know, I'd love to participate and help out as an advisor. And that sort of that journey over a couple of years was very humbled and fortunate. Many of those founders then asked me to come in and participate in follow-on financing rounds. And that's how I kind of informally kickstarted my career as an investor a couple of years back. From there, I kind of wrote several angel checks and really just fell in love with, you know, being a founder that's kind of 80 hours a week in one business is great. You have a lot of shared wins and losses with your internal team. But, you know, as an entrepreneur, being able to leverage your time and participate silently in helping other founders, you know, on their journey, as well as an investor, silent investor, a minority investor on the sideline, that was great. And so earlier this year, we launched Bloom, our venture capital fund. We now do sub 500K checks into seed stage companies all around the world. Again, focus there on software as service businesses. They typically focus around work. So technologies in the enterprise focus on work tech or fintech. And then also, as I was thinking a lot more about my journey and some of the changes that I've been seeing in the marketplace. You know, traditionally, private equity, the kind of concept of buying out a business and, you know, typically injecting some debt into that business to suit the transaction, and then turning around elements of the business to increase costs and reduce revenue. You know, typically in software as service businesses, you know, private equity haven't really focused on companies doing less than $10 million of revenue or even EBITDA. And so it just wasn't really an area where, you know, both from the seller side, you had, you know, an optionality to liquidate your position in a company and sell to private equity. Wasn't really a market for it. And I think as kind of the community at large has now recognized that SaaS really still is in its first innings, and it's never been easier to create a software as a service business, but it's never been harder to then get scale, kind of past that first $1 million of revenue up to 10 million and then to 50 million and beyond. I think we're just going to see a trove of businesses coming to market. They're either, you know, historically venture-backed businesses that can't quite, you know, maintain and get those venture-sized returns as they plateau out and are looking for kind of a soft landing, or they're just, you know, wonderful bootstrapped profitable businesses that, you know, that the founders are looking for some expertise to come in, particularly around go-to-market and accelerate the company. And so, you know, midway through this year, we kind of saw an opportunity to, under one roof of Bloom as an investment firm, to actually launch a second sidecar fund, which was focused on majority acquisitions of other software companies. You know, we're really flexible there. We kind of, whether founders stay or transition out, you know, whether it's a minority investment and founders keep a lot of equity on the table. But yeah, so far that's you know, been extremely well received by the market. And it's just been, for me, just a really humbling journey to be out speaking with just incredible SaaS founders from all around the world. I think this week we've had calls with founders who are in Iceland, all the way back to Hong Kong, and also back in Australia, my home country. So it's been quite a year.
Nice. That's a great segue into more about Bloom. And I'm really fascinated by this approach of, you know, helping founders that want to continue with your seed investments, and then also this new kind of sidecar fund, as you called it, to literally just buy these companies, which I think is a brilliant play as a business, as Bloom, as a fund, essentially. So you're building up your portfolio. So for the founders out there that are listening that have a SaaS company, let's say they're making, you know, $5 million ARR, something like that, what would the process be to get set up and ready to sell their business? Because let's say, you know, you and I both kind of know that in the day-to-day grind, things just get chaotic. Maybe they don't keep proper records. But what would you say would be kind of the highlight things that a SaaS founder should be keeping squeaky clean to potentially exit? Hey guys, Steve here, and taking a quick pause from the interview. I know that selling a business can feel unattainable and just out of reach for everybody, but it's definitely something that is very reachable for people that are listening to this podcast with Flippa. And I've mentioned that this show is presented by Flippa. They have over 3 million users on their platform who are looking to acquire everything from content sites to e-commerce stores to SaaS platforms or even mobile applications. So if you're curious and want to know more about what your business is worth, head to flippa.com/theexit for free valuations on your business. It takes a couple minutes to literally go through, and you can just go through the whole process without committing to anything at all. So once again, flippa.com/theexit, check it out, get a valuation on your business without any commitments, and just see exactly what your valuation of your business is worth. So let's dive into the interview.
Yeah, so I think that's a fantastic question. I think there's some really tactical things that, like, I can share from our team's learnings, but I'd actually kind of do it from a more of a strategic lens, first of all, which is zoom all the way back and be like, look, yes, why exit? You know, like, is there a path where you can maintain you know, equity in the business and kind of replace yourself, move yourself into a president or a chairperson role, and, you know, bring in professional leadership into to backfill yourself and move another co-founder into your role? That's kind of the first question. We've actually seen that with a lot of companies that, we started conversations with and said, hey, I'm just 8 years into this thing. We've got it past 5 million, growth plateauing, and I don't know how to unlock future growth. So like we're dusted, we're out. And we've kind of said, look, you know, you've got a great thing. Like just, this is the beautiful thing about SaaS, right? And it's, you can just keep compounding this thing. As long as you've got, you know, your churn is in check, you can just keep maintaining your existing business and just upselling and renewing them every the cadence of contract cycle is. So I think that'd be the first thing is just, you know, as a founder level conversation, it's just like, you know, what are the goals? Is it, you know, to really just cash in the chips now and sort of pass over majority ownership to someone else? Is it to stay on the board? And from there, you know, we've seen a lot of companies that have, you know, gone through sometimes like a 4 to 6 quarter process of saying, okay, historically we've been, you know, optimizing for growth, which means we're happy to run at a net loss on a, you know, quarterly annualized basis. Mm-hmm. It burns probably a little bit higher. We've got that extra fancy office. We had the option of kind of outsourcing some parts of the business, but we've brought it in and kind of, you know, we're paying premiums here. And, you know, we've seen businesses that the founding team and maybe in partnership with the board have said, okay, we're actually going to take this, you know, business in a very different trajectory now. We're going to realign to get to profitability, to traverse across to a different side of running the business, get to profitability, and then look to sell the business. And sometimes that could take several quarters to do that thoughtfully. So that'd be some of the questions I'd be starting to think through, you know, kind of strategically as a founder. And then, you know, let's say you've kind of arrived at an answer of like whether the business going to market, you know, it's a growth stage business. And when we think about growth stage, I'd say that's, you know, north of 50% annual growth rate. Or if it's a business that maybe is plateaued out and it's kind of, you know, you're really starting to have those conversations with private equity shops. It's kind of doing that 10 to, you know, sub 25% annualized growth rate as a SaaS business. And so you'd be then looking to say, okay, well, how's this business going to be valued? I mean, that want to be the first things. And again, I just see this again, having been on both sides of the aisle. Like it's not like I'm a career professional investor my entire career who's then, you know, evaluating and valuing businesses purely off a spreadsheet. I've started my career on the operating side of the aisle. And so, you know, understand the Kool-Aid that it's sometimes easy to drink as a founder when you, you know, see that the headlines of Slack being bought for $27 billion and you're like, well, I'm playing the same game. I at least have a shot at that upside. Right. And so just kind of tempering with some reality of like, okay, like what does market value my business at today? Am I going to be valued based on ARR or revenue multiples because I'm a growth stage business still and I'm growing, you know, yearly more than 50% revenue? Or maybe I'm being valued by market as more of a EBITDA profitability basis. And then of course it's like, well, who are the potential buyers? You know, are there some strategics? Should you look to speak with some of your, you know, competitors in market, or is there someone that's got a product that's tangential where you can sell your product into them, sell the business, they can wrap up the product, they'd love to work with your team, and importantly, the customer list, they can cross-sell their product across to your customers? Or is it more of a financial suitor where it's kind of a case of, look, we're just going to sell to a private equity shop and kind of they can do what they want with the business from there? But again, there's some more of the considerations. Tactically, in terms of how to get prepared, I mean, we kind of see it bucketed across like 4 different areas, which would be around like 1, legals. And I'll kind of come back and touch on a few of these areas. So like 1, legals, 2, technology, obviously. Thirdly is around the commercial side of the business. And then fourth is around like operations. Mm-hmm. So really just making sure like you're already starting to think through, you know, it can be pretty dinky or low fidelity, but some sort of data room where you've just got, you know, again, we see this a lot with bootstrap businesses where the company directors is maybe 1 or N number of founders. You know, they've never really had they've never had to raise like outside capital in debt or equity. And so maybe they don't have the kind of the formalization or probably the good hygiene that an outside buyer or acquirer may expect. So I think starting that process early, you know, making sure you've just got everything loaded up into that room and sort of, you know, good operational hygiene around all the legal documents, you know, all the customer contracts, all your employee agreements, IP assignment of your code base, everything, which is, you know, all going to be pretty standard checklist from the acquirer to look through. And obviously a quick Google search of that online, you know, they're kind of, you know, standard list. But yeah, sometimes, you know, like we've heard from you know, a lot of other private equity firms that sometimes they send across, you know, 600 line due diligence checklist to, you know, to SaaS companies that are doing $1 million of revenue. So it's, it can be a pretty lengthy, heavy lift. And again, I think that's one of the things that we try to do here at Bloom is just to really zero in on the things that we know are kind of going to be table stakes, kind of like code reds for us, go, no go gates. And then everything else is kind of nice to have and try to make it a much lighter lift for the founding team. So the process of, you know, having that conversation around a potential transaction isn't, you know, too much of a distraction to the management team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I had a conversation on a previous episode with Sandra Spielberg, and she talks a lot about the new startup mindset around, you know, myself, I lived in San Francisco for 5 years. You lived in San Francisco for 5 years. And we've all kind of been around the whole raise venture capital, you know, attach the rocket ship on or the rocket fuel into the rocket ship and take off and just grow at all costs. And it's great for some companies, and other companies, you know, may or may not need that level of supercharger attached to it. And I love that you touched on bootstrapped companies. And when I was talking about this with Sandra, you know, we talked about the different ways that people approach business. And with Bloom, when people come to you, they're from all walks of life. You guys are kind of agnostic, which I love about industry, geography, you know, it's all walks, which I always appreciate and love it when that's happening. And from your perspective, just as a founder, you know, what do you see as the deal flow that's coming to you guys? Would you say it's majority people that have raised a previous round of funding? Is it people that are bootstrapped are the majority? Or how does that split look in your opinion? And it doesn't have to be like an official percentage or anything like that. But I'm always curious, like, because there's different types of businesses, of course, and there's no one right way to do a business. But I'm always curious as to who comes to you guys as like, I want to exit. Are they primarily bootstrappers? Are they primarily people that have raised funding in the past?
Yeah, great question. So, and you I guess you framed it as like who comes to us, and I kind of re-changed the question a little bit. It's who do we go out to, and then who comes in down to us as well, and that's what constructs our deal flow. And so that it is quite nuanced, and not to be kind of like sound like the classic lawyer here of like, well, it depends, or like, well, we're right down the middle here, but like kind of are. You know, we've spent a bunch of time. I mean, look, if you're going out to a business that's, let me wind back. I'll answer the question indirectly. We started a conversation. We sent out an email to a company. We'd been market mapping a sector that we were particularly excited by and kind of long on the future. Obviously, that had some pretty big you know, undercurrents going through that market segment through COVID, and we were particularly excited by that category. So we market mapped who are the folks in the space we wanted to speak with that we thought tangentially fit our criteria of like, hey, they're not going to be too big, doing $60 million of revenue already with 400 employees. Obviously, that's not our focus. We focus up to around $6, $7 million of ARR. And so we reached out to one founding team and, you know, had this like classic reaction that the founder had already sold the business before, it was bootstrapped. He then took the next and current company through an accelerator program, mm-hmm. and raised a pretty big seed round after that. Got some early momentum, you know, put the fuel in, rocket took off, rocket plateaued very early. And after 4 years, we're doing kind of $1 million of revenue, which is, again, subjective. It's great for many, many businesses, great for many, many founders. But for this particular founder with their expectations, you know, he'd had a pretty significant exit in his previous business. And certainly for the investors, like it was almost a borderline of flop. And so they were looking at like what to do. And, you know, he was kind of lamenting and saying, look, I've now got this business to such a size of like headcount because we're just trying to grow this thing. And it's just so much headwind and friction. And he's like, you know, I'm a maker, not a manager. Like, I just want to get back to just writing lines of code, but now I'm stuck here doing payroll and all this clerical operational side of the business. And, you know, like growth is just stalled out completely. It's like, so, you know, we said, look, like, how can we find a way to work together? And he's like, well, I just don't think the board's going to go for it. Like, there's so much complexity around the cap table now and different board members, different investors from different VC firms on the board have different motivations and goals and thoughts around like the future of the company. And so we kind of said, look, we'll be here to help if you ever want to like pick up the conversation again. But you know, just look at a case study as, you know, one example of many, many, many stories that I hear of founders who kind of get trapped into these businesses just because of the cap table and previous financing complexity. So look, we obviously speak to a lot of those types of companies. Sometimes it's a little simpler, you know, within a venture capital firm, you know, there's a company that's maybe pivoted a product and they're going after a new product direction with a second product, and they're looking to divest or carve out the first product. And so we'll definitely speak to a lot of founding teams or management teams that have taken on external capital. But you know, there's somehow kind of, we call them kind of the fallen angels or the venture orphans. Like they just haven't been able to get to that breakout trajectory that that everyone had at the you know, the origin of taking on that financing. You know, additionally, or conversely rather, it, you know, to some of those factors that I mentioned with that story or anecdote a moment ago, with that founder kind of being a little trapped and beholden to the and being outvoted at the board level. You know, obviously it's a little easier when you're speaking to bootstrap companies because they just, you know, the board typically is an example. Like we were speaking with a husband and wife team this week, and the business is doing now north of $7 million of revenue. They own 100% of the business together with a 30-person team, and you know, doing great things. And it's like, well, when we decide, we decide, and that's it. It's just the two of us to sign off. So, you know, it really varies, but I think, you know, we're starting to see like clear differences in the experience of working with different founding teams based on whether they're bootstrapped or they've raised external capital.
Yeah, right on. I love stories like that. The husband and wife doing 7 million, owning 100% of it. And that's incredible. And that's a good segue kind of into, you touched on, you know, what you were excited about. Like you guys found you were doing market research around a company and figuring out that, you know, during the pandemic and everything, there's a lot of potential in the future potentially. So just kind of changing gears a little bit, what are you excited about in 2021 in terms of industries that you guys are looking at? And, you know, you don't have to tell us everything that's in your pipeline or something like that. But I'm just always curious, since you have your hand on the pulse with, you know, companies that have done really well through the chaotic year that 2020 has been, what are you looking forward to in terms of industry, given you guys are agnostic and you can really do this anywhere, in terms of your investment strategy? What are you looking forward to?
Yeah, great question. So one of the kind of the highest virtues that we have in looking for, you know, great products and teams and businesses to acquire and work alongside is just being mission critical products. And I think, you know, speaking again, wearing my former founder builder hat, you know, I've definitely been guilty of building kind of vitamin water as opposed to painkiller products over the year. And we all know the pull you get from market when you found product market fit with a painkiller. And so we just basically look at, and we can deep dive and understand metrics around, you know, net promoter score, customer retention, you know, sources of marketing, where the leads are coming from. Obviously there's usually, you know, very high NPS, high retention, high product usage, high customer referral rate as a source of where leads are coming from. In terms of those sectors, again, we're really broad. I mean, we've got a couple of theses that we're very interested in. I mean, obviously anything that's kind of, we definitely have a preference to enterprise SaaS as opposed to, you know, prosumer, consumer SaaS. And we love bottoms up sales models as well, where you have that, you know, really low or light touch sales experience. I mean, some of the most amazing companies that we idolize is that, you know, the Dropbox, the Atlassians of the world, where they've, you know, just built out these beautiful products where you know, credit card sign up, away you go, $19, sub $50, sub $100 for a license. And, you know, it's kind of the BYOT, bring your own tool or device into work, and is mission critical. You know, it ingests all of that team or individual and then team and then department and then ultimately organizations workflow and proprietary data, which forms that key lock-in and moat that we love, which obviously leads to high retention and upsells. So, you know, any tools that we look for around kind of like dev tools is an area. Again, obviously we know that challenge affecting a lot of organizations right now is kind of, you know, given this proliferation of SaaS over the last, you know, half decade or more, you know, now there's kind of, we've gone from these all-in-one tools to now best of breed, which means pick the average department, okay, Mr. Mrs. and Mr. Finance, instead of having two or three tools to run it all, you've now probably got 15, 16 tools just in that department. And do they all have APIs talking to each other? Probably not. And so you've got these major siloed impacts across, kind of putting up walls across organizations. And so, we have a thesis that we're looking for tools that, really make employees' lives better and organizations more productive as well, which is pretty high level and esoteric, but it's kind of, if it meets that, then we kind of think that that's going to be, a tailwind that we can ride and surf along for many years. Yeah.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I love that you've been on both sides of the aisle. You've been the operator, the founder, the builder, and now you're on the funder side of things. You're on the investor side, which I love. So that makes this question much, much more fun to ask. So knowing what you know now, what would you tell Bart 10 years ago?
Yeah, great question. I think about this a lot with some of my mentors as well. I think leaning, something that I've spent a lot of time actually just this year alone reflecting on is your circle of competence and kind of understanding. I think no one's going to be great at all things, whether you're a founder and you come from a finance background or a product background or a commercial background. I sure, like many of the listeners, would listen to any of these podcasts and I'm like, wow, this person knows so much and kind of have this horrible imposter syndrome. And I've kind of probably been a little bit easier on myself in recent years, realizing that like everyone's just on their journey and trying to learn and play the game as best as they can together. And, really leaning into that circle of competence, which is saying, where's my edge? On a 4-point rating system, I'm probably going to be 5 out of 4 at like 2 or 3 things, like truly, top 10% in the world at, and that's my edge. And then there are things that like, I'm probably a 2 out of 4 at. It used to really gripe me that there were things that I was 2 out of 4 at. I was like, gosh, I really got to get up to 3. And I think what I've just realized as I've probably matured and had more experience working around great teams is just like the kind of the hack of just hiring amazing talent and delegating and just kind of not necessarily focus on trying to lift up all of your weaknesses, but rather just leaning into the things that you're truly world-class at and then partnering up with amazingly talented folks who are great complementary fits.
Well said. Well said. Well, that's all the questions I have for you today, Bart. Where can people go and learn more about Bloom Venture Partners?
Yeah, absolutely. So check out our website, bloomvp.com. We're also pretty active on social and we've got our own podcast series launching shortly for folks that are interested specifically on SaaS conversations. So we're interviewing a bunch of interesting founders and investors and other kind of small cap SaaS acquirers. So you can come and check that out. And then last thing, we just actually introduced a scout program as well. So folks out there who maybe me listeners of yours and part of the amazing Flipper community, if they know other people who are running SaaS companies who might be interested in either taking investment or taking selling their company altogether over to the team at Bloom. Yeah, we have a paid scout program where you can get paid out when a deal closes in cold hard cash, and look forward to hang out on our first one of those scout programs very, very shortly.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, wherever you guys are listening on SoundCloud, Spotify, or iTunes, the notes will be full of the links that Bart just mentioned. So definitely check that out. Once again, thank you so much for coming on the show, Bart.
Really appreciate it. Have a great rest of your week, Sid.